Haven't a clue. But I figure that if I keep him occupied with the thumb, it'll at least hold his interest until I come up with something. Walter, I don't need to remind you that you are not a professional in dealing with these types of things and that there are people who...
I know that.
Your friend, Dr. Morton, at the VA over in Sheridan?
Yeah, but that would make it official. And I'm not sure Santiago would be willing to go for that.
The doc pulled at his nose, readjusted his glasses with a middle finger, and studied me for a long moment.
What do you want me to do?
I shrugged. Nothing illegal. But if you could feign a little ignorance about the nature of the evidence and possibly keep it quiet if anybody comes in with a telling injury. He pulled the all-knowing clipboard from his chest, flipped a page over, and read. Mr. Felix Polk of Route 16, Rural Delivery Box 12, appeared here yesterday at approximately 11:22 a.m., wanting to know if anybody had shown up with the end of his thumb because he, and I quote, wanted to get it back and have it made into a keychain, unquote. I took a breath. Well, this might end up being a little harder than I thought, but I'll think of something. I started to go, but then remembered that I wanted to ask him about Mrs. Dobbs. Hey, Doc, you remember Betty Dobbs? He thought for only a second. School nurse and teacher. Retired, isn't she? Married well, as I recall, but he died 2.5 years ago, I think. He didn't hesitate in adding, salt of the earth. Why?
Just curious.
Ozzie Dobbs apparently wanted to press charges, but I thought that Geo didn't. So I took the trail of least resistance and went to visit the junk man first. I knocked on the door of his room, but there was no response. I could hear the television, so I waited a second and then swung the door back. Geo was walking around in a high-here's-my-ass gown, barefoot, and looking for his clothes. He was still wearing his disreputable hat with the flap sticking straight out at the sides, so it looked like Geo was clear for takeoff.
What do you think them nurses did with my pants?
Burned them, I thought, but I wasn't going to be the one to tell them. I think you're supposed to be in bed, Geo. They have to give you one more going over before they'll let you go, probably something to do with the insurance. The response was predictable.
Goddamn insurance.
He stood there in the middle of the room with his fists on his hips. His tan, still holding through the winter, started just above his eyebrows and paused in a deep V at his throat, along which there was a substantial scar that appeared to run from ear to ear. The tan then recommenced at his wrists and ventured to his fingertips. I guess they had cleaned him up with or without his permission, because the rest of him looked like boiled chicken.
Somebody gotta feed Butch and Sundance.
What about Duane or Gina? His answer was accompanied with a vague gesture.
Went off to Sheridan to go to the show and visit friends.
How about Morris?
Drinks.
I thought about how I was supposed to have met Vic an hour ago, and how my current popularity was plummeting along with the mercury. Well then, I can take care of that. He studied me from the corner of his eye.
Got a bird?
I walked over and lowered the volume on the television. I can probably take care of that for you, too. It was Natalie Wood and some guy I can't remember singing in West Side Story. I thought it an odd choice for the junk man, but pretty good programming since we were coming up on Valentine's Day.
Got nary a feather.
I turned back to look at him. I beg your pardon?
Lindy, got nary a feather.
The bird? He nodded.
Plucks them all off in spite.
In spite of what?
Daughter-in-law run off. Only one that could stand the bird.
I thought about it. Geo, didn't your daughter-in-law leave a while back?
10 years ago, June 12th.
He evidently felt the need to add,
parrot can live a long time. Could be the spite.
I crossed to the visitor chair and sat in hopes that he'd settle on the bed so we could discuss recent developments. Geo, I need to talk to you. To my relief, he came over and predictably beat me to the punch of my visit.
Not making a charge.
I smiled at him. I'm glad to hear that. He sniffed, probably unused to smelling anything but himself.
Perfect right to.
Yes, you do, but then Ozzie Jr. will probably bring up the fact that your gun went off.
Accidental.
I nodded. I agree. But I just wanted to nip any problem we might have in the bud. I stretched my leg. Geo, I'd like to ask what that was all about.
Do you and Ozzy have something going on I should know about?" His attention focused on his feet, which were aligned with the legs of his chair.
"Nope."
"Nothing?" He pushed his welding cap back, revealing the stunning whiteness of his forehead and a perfect widow's peak.
"Nope."
I waited a moment and then stood.
"All right, then. When are you going to feed Butch and Sundance in the beard?"
It seemed like an urgent request.
"Tonight?"
He nodded.
"Dog food's in the garbage can in the mudroom. Bird feed in the urn on the shelf by the cage. There's cat food on the back porch for the raccoons."
"Raccoons?" He nodded.
"Make sure they got water in the heated bowl. And stay out of the basement. There's snakes."
I took a deep breath. It was turning out to be a long day.
"You want me to feed them, too?" "Nope."
"Snakes, Joe?"
"Yep.
In February." I stood there looking down at him, noting again that he was composed of thin, drawn muscle that displayed every strand and sinew. "Are those wolves of yours going to try and eat me alive when I go back there?" The smile faltered a little on his lips, and not for the first time I noticed there was an odd elegance to the man.
"Nope."
I wasn't sure if I believed him. The effects of the drops were gone, and I no longer needed a personal chauffeur, so Dog and I drove the 8 miles to the dump in the dark alone. I cut the motor on my truck, but left the headlights to shine on the snack bar municipal solid waste facility office. I cracked the Bullet's door open, and Dog looked at me expectantly. I looked at the office and could see them waiting, dark eyes flaring in the window. I grabbed my mag light from the seat, reached in, and clicked off the headlights. "No, I think you better stay in here." He didn't look happy, but I closed the door behind me and slowly made my way toward the patched together shack. I shined the beam of the big flashlight onto the plexiglass and into the two sets of glowing eyes. I placed a hand on the aluminum knob, but then thought it best to introduce myself from the safety between us. So I put my other hand against the thick, clear plastic and spoke softly. "Okay. If I open this damn door, and either one of you makes the slightest sign of aggression, I'm leaving the two of you to starve. You got me?" I tried to think of the last time I'd been bitten by a dog, and could only come up with a nasty little shih tzu that had nipped my elbow in the Busy Bee Cafe during rodeo weekend 2 years back. One of the big, lean heads stretched forward. I'm not sure if it was Butch or Sundance, but he licked the clear plastic against my hand. "All right. Here we go." I pulled the door open, and they continued to sit there, looking at me like 120-pound bookends. "Okay, good dogs. Good boys." I reached a closed fist toward the one that had licked the plexiglass and watched as the black-and-white muzzle moved forward for a sniff and then a lick. I rolled my hand over and let the wet tongue lap across my palm. His fan-like tail swept back and forth, and I thought, so far so good, which caused me to make a mistake and reach for the other wolf mutt, who up to this point hadn't made any movement or sound. The rumble in his chest sounded like the internal combustion of a high-compression motor and just as urgent. I looked at him. "Hey." He backed away just a little and pulled up one side of his muzzle to show me the business end of a canine tooth as he continued to growl. "Hey!" He backed away until his butt bumped against the far wall, which really wasn't far enough. His lip dropped a little, but he stayed there watching me as I ran a hand over the head of the friendlier of the two in hope that if he saw the other dog respond well, he might loosen up a bit. I turned my focus marginally to the dog I was petting. "Good dog. If historical reference is any good in judging personality, I'm betting you're Butch." He looked up, and I was relatively assured. The other dog was no longer growling, and dipped its head as I kept petting the friendlier one.
"Come on, Sundance. Come on, Butch."
I took the path from the office that led to Gio's house and headed off at a slow walk past my truck. Butch kept pace at my left as we followed the frozen, hard-packed road. Sundance tagged along behind. I glanced at the truck and could see that my backup was watching and committing every movement to memory. We walked past the chain-link fence. The sign on the other side read, "Stewart Junkyard, no trespassing," spelling notwithstanding.
The gate was held in place by a rubber bungee cord, but still moved a couple of inches, squealing in counterpoint with the wind that was picking up from the mountains. I stopped and held the metal-framed gate in one hand, thankful I was wearing gloves so that my flesh didn't stick, and ushered the first dog through. The other one stood and looked at me. "Come on." He waited a short moment and then followed, keeping his distance as I looked down the path at the gables of the big house. Douglas Moomy had built the place in the late 1890s, but after the death of his brother in the Boer War, he was called back to England from a life of drunken remittance to a life of drunken privilege. The only thing he'd left behind were illegitimate children who spoke with a vague British accent and the house. A local cattle rancher bought it and the surrounding property, and it remained in his family until the late 40s, at which point Shirley Vandermeer, one of the local call girls, acquired it as a result of an heir chasing aces and eights. There was supposedly an old tunnel that had run from the whorehouse to a livery almost an eighth of a mile away, which allowed the local ranchers and cowboys ingress and, more important, egress in times of emergency, such as when the sheriff might be looking for patrons of the establishment. As I stood among the random, rusted automobile carcasses that were stacked around it, it was hard to imagine the place in its original glory. The gigantic house squatted on a native moss rock foundation like the place had grown there. The night clouds raced over the roof like fleeting spirits, and the tendrils of a long dead cottonwood split trunk ran its bony fingers through the clouds. Only the insistent bite of the northwestern wind and sub-zero temperatures reminded me that it was Valentine's Day and not Halloween. There was no paint to peel, so the structure had slowly gone monochromatic from its balustrades and verandas to its shriveled and checked shingles. More than a few of those shingles lay at my feet, most likely victim to Geo's latest stint as chimney sweep. There was a plume of smoke coming from the blackened bricks, and it looked like there was a light on somewhere in the back of the house. I figured that Gina and Duane must have come back from the movies early. The dogs had stopped at the base of the stairs to turn and look at me. I gave the entire house one more quick glance. "I'm coming." Automobile parts, scrap metal, and large derelict appliances were scattered on the porch, as well as the patchy iced yard. I picked my way around a Ford 9-inch differential, a 50 Willys Jeepster grill, and the seat from a mid-60s Impala. The steps were warped and cupped, but held as I climbed onto the porch. "Sheriff Department?" I waited, but there was no response, so I opened the front door and followed the wolves inside. There was a set of stairs in the entry hall with a stained oriental runner complete with tarnished brass rails on each rise. The carpet had been tracked black, and the worn spots at the center of each tread showed the oak board underneath, the distressed wool threads drifting in the air of the open door as if the stairwell had been disemboweled. The green wainscoting had crinkled its stain and pulled away from the surface of the wood like a skinned alligator, and brocaded wallpaper hung in strips from the plaster and lath walls. In the partial moonlight of the parlor windows, the human hair that had been mixed with the plaster curlicued from the wall. Mixing hair with plaster was a common practice of the period, but it was still a little unsettling. There was a door under the stairs that must have led to the basement. Snakes. Junk was everywhere, stacks of moldy books, newspapers and magazines, a portable air compressor, a broken ladder, and a floor fan with no blades were just a few of the items within reach. Amazingly, though, the air felt humid. The dogs were waiting for me in the archway of the back hall that led to what had to be the kitchen, but I detoured to my right and stared at the bluish-gray trapezoids of moonlight, revealing boot prints that disturbed the dust on the floor. There were two large, overstuffed reading chairs facing the fireplace and, as the chimney had indicated, the smoldering remains of a fire. A small, round, battered Chippendale table with a Coleman lantern planted on top sat between the two chairs. None of the furniture looked to be in particularly good condition, but one chair had a sheet carefully draped over it with a large book spread open on it, binding up. Overtaken with curiosity, I took the five steps and leaned in to read the gilt writing on the tattered cover. The Complete Works of William Shakespeare. I stuck a finger between the pages, lifted up the volume, and flipped it over. Act 2, Scene 6, Romeo and Juliet, not the most memorable excerpt from the play. A few lines close to the bottom of the page had been underlined with a dull pencil which, upon closer examination, was also on the seat of the chair. I picked it up and placed it in the center of the open book and read, "They are but beggars that can count their worth. But my true love is grown to such excess I cannot sum up some of half my wealth." My estimation of G.O. Stewart was rising as I closed the pencil in the collected works, eraser out, and returned it to the seat of the chair. I glanced back into the entryway, but the dogs weren't there, probably waiting for me in the kitchen. I stepped to the fireplace and unhooked a well-used fire iron, crouched, and started stoking the remnants that remained between the glowing amber eyes of the owl-shaped andirons. There were a few sparks, and the ends rolled to the center, reigniting the fire and giving the place a bit more cheer and, needless to say, warmth. There was a noise from the kitchen, and I figured I'd better get to feeding the wild bunch before they decided to take it upon themselves. I stood and started for the main hall, looked through the glass partition toward the pantry, and thought I saw someone. I froze and stood there without moving, blinking my eyes steadily, thinking it must have been the residual effect of this afternoon's drops. But the image of a woman dressed completely in 19th-century clothes passed through the hallway behind the beveled glass. With the light reflecting through the hinged doors of the kitchen and the stained glass side panels, I could see she was wearing a deep red ball gown, complete with high collar and a bustle. I thought I should investigate, and had just started toward the swinging doors when they both opened.
"Oh, my lord!"
She placed her hands at her chest and looked at me wide-eyed. The doors flapped closed behind her.
"Oh, my lord!"
"Mrs. Dobbs?" I finished off my slice of apple pie and took a sip of my coffee, the communal silence weighing heavily on the two of us. We sat at a small table by the kitchen window. The kitchen, as opposed to the rest of the house, was spotless. There was a gigantic 6-burner porcelain stove with 4 ovens, a massive refrigerator, and cabinets that had been scrubbed within an inch of their grain. The floor and the walls up to the chair rail were those tiny octagonal tiles set in a pattern that even in the dim lights of the antique fixtures glistened around the room like a jeweler's showcase. The only thing disturbing the decor were the 2 lumps of wolf dogs that lay snoring in the corner by the back door. "Good pie, good coffee, too." I set the thick china cup down. She nodded and continued to sip from the mug she held in both hands. Her pupils were a soft blue, but the edges looked hard and dark, reminiscent of the blue willow china that was carefully displayed in the highboy by the stove. Her hair was long, and the way she looked, it was hard to remember that she was probably a member of AARP, and that she'd been the one who had introduced me to Big Bill Shakespeare in the 9th grade. "Nice dress." She laughed, and I figured I was getting somewhere. She put her coffee cup down and folded her hands in her lap.
"You must find all this a little strange."
I shrugged. "A little." She pointed at my plate.
"It started with an apple."
"It always does." She laughed some more, a melodious sound that made me want to be funny.
"I was stealing them from George."
She half turned in her seat and gestured outside.
"There's a lovely little stand of apple trees off the path and up near the old cellar. I was there last fall and was picking apples for apple butter, that or looking for a tree tall enough from which I could hang myself."
I said nothing. After a moment of not looking at me, she continued.
"He wasn't angry. As a matter of fact, I think he was surprised and pleased to see somebody. We talked, and he offered to get some paper grocery bags and help me carry the apples back home. The next week I brought him some apple butter."
She laughed again, without any prompting from me.
"You know why I like George so much? Because he doesn't apologize for anything. He just does what he pleases and doesn't concern himself with what other people think."
She leaned forward and propped her chin up with the palm of her hand.
It seems like I have spent most of my life apologizing for things. And it seems to me that if I hadn't been selected to absorb some of George's sly yet beneficent spell, my life might now be quite different. She stopped talking, started to say something, but then changed her mind. We sat there in the silence till I gave her an out. Could I have some more coffee?
Why, yes, of course.
She stood, smoothed the elaborate dress, and crossed to the stove where she plucked the white speckled coffee pot from a burner she had turned to low. She refilled my cup, placed the pot on a knitted holder at the center of the table, and watched me drink.
I guess I should explain that hanging remark, hmm?
You don't have to.
It's been a rough couple of years, with Ozzy Sr. dying.
I fiddled with the handle of my cup. I'd imagine so.
I mean, it wasn't a surprise. He'd had health problems for quite some time.
I smiled at her with all my heart, or as much as was in my throat. Mrs. Dobbs, you don't have to explain any of this to me.
I sat back in my chair.
You see, I would file this under personal business. I learned a long time ago that matters of the heart are well outside my jurisdiction.
She smiled with a little down curve before the kick at the corner of her lips. It was similar to the smile that Vic had used to a devastating effect. Thank you for that, Walter.
She looked down at the laced fingers in her lap.
Maybe I just needed someone to talk to about all this.
I took a deep breath and let it out slowly. In that case, I'm all ears. I fingered the disfigured one. Or ear and a half. I smiled. Does anybody else know about this relationship?
She hugged herself and looked out the window, where condensation from the heat of the stove was clouding the view. Ozzy Jr. may have some suspicions, but that's all.
She continued to try and see through the glass and finally got to the subject she was looking for.
Your wife died a few years ago, didn't she?
Yes, about six years ago. She took a deep breath of her own.
If you don't mind my asking, in what way did it affect you?
I told her the truth because I thought it was something she needed to hear. I wanted to die. And I don't mean that figuratively. They take a big chunk of you when they go. She nodded, but just barely.
Yes.
There's a friend of mine, an Indian.
She smiled. Henry Standing Bear?
I shook my head. No, another Indian, half Cheyenne and half Crow, by the name of Brandon White Buffalo. I paused to remember the words the large man had used while I'd eaten his carefully prepared breakfast sandwich in Lame Deer at the Sinclair station that bore his name. He said that it's like losing a part of yourself, but worse because we're left with who we are after. And sometimes we don't recognize that person.
She sighed a soft laugh. So, we're lost to ourselves?
Pretty much. She poured herself a little more from the enameled pot with the clear gem-like percolator top.
Do you still think about your late wife?
I do.
How often?
I smiled weakly. Used to be every minute. Then once a day. I guess I've toughened myself so that I only think about her when I see something that reminds me of her. She gripped her mug, and I noticed that the thin band of skin at her ring finger was still pale. That give you hope?
Not overly.
Well, you might be tougher than I am. Most people are. She didn't smile this time. And it was as if the hard edges at the outside of her pupils had become sharper.
I don't think I believe that.
I shrugged. Either way, I'd never be able to get away with a frock like that. That got a laugh.
I was wondering how long it was going to take you to get around to asking again.
It's a very nice dress.
Thank you. She was self-conscious now, so I waited. George likes it.
He found it at the dump. It was in a bunch of boxes that the community theater had thrown out when they stopped doing their annual melodrama.
I didn't think I should follow that line any further.